Blog Talk Radio. Greetings.
This is Abayomi Adekunle, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Adekunle. Today is Saturday, July the 9th, 2022. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. Later on in this program, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the continuing instability in Sri Lanka, where the president has announced he will step down later this month. Japan is mourning the assassination of former President Shinzo Abe, who was killed while campaigning for his party on Friday in Japan. Ethiopia and the African Union have embarked upon a new health initiative for the continent. We'll have details on that as well. And the former president of the Republic of Angola, José Eduardo dos Santos, has died at the age of 79. We'll have discussions and analysis of his contributions to the African Revolution. In the second hour, we look at the reaction in Africa to the death of former President Dos Santos. Finally, we will examine some of the major issues impacting Africa and the world today. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We're going to, of course, bring you our musical interlude. And, of course, we are going to the East African state of the United Republic of Tanzania, to the Zanzibar Island for the music Hot and Dar. Let's listen in.
Matatizo kwetu Baba anae Nilini utarudi ya nyumbani Uje uwaone watoto wako Uje uwaone baba na mama kwetu Fanye kila njia Kwani kuna matatizo Matatizo, matatizo kwetu Baba anae Nilini utarudi ya nyumbani Uje uwaone watoto wako Uje uwaone baba na mama kwetu hawezi kuhangaika huku na kule. Kwa hiyo pana ufanye haraka, matatizo yametuzidi. Watoto wako wanakukumbuka kila siku, wawishi kukuuliza, na mama naye ananung'unika, kwani miaka mingi imepita. Baba amekuwa mtu mzima, hawezi kuhangaika huku na kule. Kwa hiyo pana ufanye haraka, matatizo yametuzidi. Fanya uje
yewe nasema
fanya uje
bwana naomba
fanya uje
niko peke yangu
fanya uje
maisha ya tabu
fanya uje
kila kitu ni pesa
fanya uje
chakula ni pesa
fanya uje
mavazi ni pesa
fanya uje
bwana
fanya uje
fanya haraka
fanya uje
leo nasema
fanya uje
bwana
marafiki tukatumie. Nilikuwa napata pesa nyingi, lakini matumizi yangu ya hali ya juu. Ninapokuwa na pesa mfukoni, na watafuta marafiki tukatumie.
Nikiingia kwenye bandi na chenga laka.
Eh, domana mekisika, sisi kasi mwe.
Sina pesa ya mchezo.
Nasa pesa mzime mwishia, kasi mwe. Ana la kufanya,
Kisika kweli kabisa.
Nasa pesa mzime mwishia, kasi mwe. Ana la kufanya,
Mola die mumbe Thank you. wake umenikasiri kia kama mimi ndio nilikutuma
sura yako na ulivyo kasiri kama mae ndio mimi wazidi kunicharamba kumaya sango
madala yako jana alipita kunieleza lakini mimi hata kidogo sikumua
kilichotutenganisha. Wewe mtaraka wangu, dadi mwenzangu we. Ukaanza kunitangaza vibaya, mimi mama
tanganyike na jewo buli chopata udara ubaza
kubadai kana dunia
mwana bibaya e
bibaya mwana bibaya
mwana bibaya e
bibaya mwana bibaya
And that was classic Pan-African music from the United Republic of Tanzania and, of course, from the region of Zanzibar. Hot and Dar is the name of that collection of illustrious African music. Yes, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, July 9th, 2022. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of our program. We're going to move into our Pan-African Newswatch segment. Our lead story deals with the current political crisis in the South Asian state of Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka's president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, will step down on July 13th, which is only 4 days away. According to news agencies, they said this earlier today, they were citing Speaker Mahinda Yapa Abewardina. According to the international press, Rajapaksa has informed that he will resign on July the 13th. Earlier today, an emergency meeting of the leaders of political parties chaired by Speaker of the Sri Lankan Parliament, Mahinda Yapa Abewardina, was held in the wake of mass protests. The participants in the meeting agreed that incumbent President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe should resign, and that the Speaker of the Parliament should take over as provisional president for no longer than 30 days. Sri Lanka's Parliament will elect for the remaining term. Additionally, the meeting ruled to appoint a provisional all-party government and to hold elections in the near future. Earlier in the day, thousands of protesters took to the streets of Colombo demanding that Rajapaksa's resignation. They stormed his residence and then the prime minister's residence in Temple Trees, which they later set it on fire. Over 30 people were injured in the protest. Wickremesinghe announced amid the rebellion that would step down. The protests sparked by financial and economic crises have engulfed the country since early April. As Wickremesinghe told the international press in an exclusive interview, Sri Lanka is hit hard by the worst crisis in modern history, and the island nation's politicians did not find the parallels to such a crisis in this century or in the last century or the century before. According to the prime minister, the country is currently in the middle of the crisis. Wickremesinghe pointed out that Sri Lanka was facing severe shortages of foreign currencies, fuel and petroleum products, fertilizers, food for some groups of the population, and medicines. According to his estimates, it would take 3 years or even more to recover from economic crisis. And another news from Sri Lanka. The head of state, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, managed to leave the residence minutes before demonstrators got to its territory, a defense ministry source reported. Protesters did break into the Sri Lankan president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa's residence. That's according to the international press. They reported this earlier today. The head of state managed to leave the residence minutes before demonstrators got to its territory, a defense ministry said. Rajapaksa is still considered the country's president, and he is currently protected by the military, the same source told the various news agencies. Since early April, Sri Lanka has been hit by protests against the deteriorating living conditions, the lack of fuel, food, and essentials. Sri Lanka is experiencing its worst economic crisis since independence in 1948. It resulted from a contraction of foreign tourism due to the pandemic, which led to the shortage of foreign currency reserves in the country. In this environment, the authorities were forced to cut imports and introduce tight resources and savings. External debt, which totals $51 billion U.S. dollars, hinders Sri Lanka's making external borrowing and struggling against the economic crisis. And in other news in Asia, the funeral of Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who was assassinated just yesterday, will take place on July the 12th. That's according to the Kyoto News Agency. The agency also added that the funeral would be organized at Shinzo Abe's hometown in Shimonoseki, Yamaguchi Prefecture. The 67-year-old politician was assassinated in the city of Nara at about noon on July the 8th as he was delivering a political campaign speech ahead of the country's parliamentary election scheduled for July 10th. Tetsuya Yamagami, a 41-year-old Japanese national, fired two shots at the former prime minister using a homemade firearm. Abe was immediately rushed to a hospital by helicopter. He received a blood transfusion. Doctors fought for his life for several hours, but we were unable to save him, they said. The assailant said later that he was frustrated with Abe's politics and conduct, and that he had nothing against the former prime minister's political views. Now, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, will not attend the funeral of Japan's former prime minister, Shinzo Abe, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov told the TASS news agency. Putin, no. The rest depends on protocol rules, he said when asked about the participation of Russia's representatives. Kyoto's news agency reported earlier the funeral of Shinzo Abe would take place on July 12th in his hometown of Shimonoseki in the Yamaguchi Prefecture. The 67-year-old politician was assassinated in the city of Nara on July the 8th as he was delivering a political campaign speech ahead of the country's parliamentary elections scheduled to come up tomorrow. Earlier, Peskov told reporters the Kremlin deeply regretted the death of former Japanese prime minister and expressed his condolences to the people of Japan. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. In other news taking place on the African continent, in the Horn of Africa state of Ethiopia, the government and the African Union Commission, which is based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, have jointly launched the 2022 African Year of Nutrition and Food Security in Ethiopia. During the launching ceremony just this last past Thursday, Ethiopian Health Minister Leah Tadesi, who is a medical doctor, said that the program is timely and such joint launch would catalyze the national level commitment to food and nutrition and exchange. It was learned that the program has been launched under the theme, Utilize the 2022 African Union Year of Nutrition to showcase the Sokoto Declaration and galvanize continental efforts in expanding successful governmental efforts towards ending stunting in Africa. While much progress has been done in Africa to tackle malnutrition in all its forms, the Global Nutrition Report indicates that malnutrition rates across Africa remains unacceptably high. Children ages infants to 5 years old are suffering from stunting. Women are particularly at risk across Africa, with more than 40% of women of reproductive age suffering from anemia. The minister noted that Ethiopia showed strong commitment by releasing a joint position statement by the Ministry of Agriculture and the Ministry of Health in support of Africa's Year of Nutrition and Food Security implementation. The government of Ethiopia reaffirmed that the theme will have a catalytic effect on its commitment to addressing and nutrition insecurity as one of the priority development areas for the country. Following the declaration, Ethiopia has been working with the African Union Commission to develop the roadmap and implementation plan where two activities incorporated to advance the Sokoto Declaration commitment, Leah said. Commissioner for Health, Humanitarian, and Social Development Ambassador Manati Samate said on the occasion that the Sokoto Declaration is the clear demonstration of the commitment of the Ethiopian government to end stunting and malnutrition. These bold initiatives prioritize high-level action to address malnutrition across the African continent and will drive increased political momentum for nutrition nationally and regionally in Africa. The African Year of Nutrition and Food Security 2022 has reaffirmed the commitment of African countries to advance their nutrition goals. And this followed with a clear investment from the domestic budget and alignment of investors behind these country-defined priorities. The minister has called upon the stakeholders development partners, donors, and others to sustain the technical and financial support for the successful of the strategy. Sharing the government of Ethiopia's commitment to food and nutrition strategy and food system transformation and related experiences showcase the Sokota Declaration Innovation Phase learning and to catalyze the implementation of the expansion phase among the government sectors and development partners. And if you want to read this article in its entirety, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African News Wire. And, of course, in the southern African state of Angola, a tall tree has fallen. Angola's former president, José Eduardo dos Santos, died just yesterday at the age of 79 at a hospital in Barcelona, Spain, after suffering cardiac arrest, the government said. With great pain and consternation, the Luanda government posted on Facebook confirmation of the dos Santos death at 11:10 a.m. or 10:10 Greenwich Mean Time. The government presents its deepest feelings of sorrow to the bereaved family, statement read, describing the former leader as a statesman of great historical stature who led the country through very difficult times. Dos Santos ruled the Portuguese-speaking oil-rich state of Angola for 38 years before stepping down in September of 2017. He was hospitalized in Spain and placed in intensive care after suffering a cardiac arrest on June the 23rd. And we'll have more information on the death of the former Angolan president, Eduardo José dos Santos, later in this edition of the Pan-African Journal. With that, we want to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners, Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website at panafricannews.com. .blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, the program that you're listening to right now, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And the program can be shared with other potential listeners by merely copying and pasting the links into emails and sending those emails out to other potential listeners. The links can be copied and posted into other blogs and websites, as well as being shared on social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, July the 9th, 2022. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break with the legendary Curtis Mayfield. We'll be back.
We gotta have peace to keep the world alive and watch to see.
Heroes, people, heroes.
The legendary Curtis Mayfield with the song entitled We Gotta Have Peace. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. I'm your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And we received news just yesterday that the former Republic of Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos, a wartime president who took over in the aftermath of the death of Dr. Austino Neto in 1979, led the country through tumultuous times, also providing international solidarity to struggles throughout the region of Southern Africa and Namibia, Republic of South Africa. Of course, the José Eduardo dos Santos legacy will be enduring. And we want to, of course, listen to some audio files discussing the late president and his contributions to the African Revolution.
The ANC military wing MK was assisted by Angola's MPLA to fight the then apartheid government in South Africa. At that time, South Africa supported the late former opposition leader, Jonas Savimbi, who was engaged in a civil war in that country. Let's discuss the role of the MPLA in the liberation of what was known as the frontline states. We are now joined by ANC International Relations Subcommittee Chair, Lindiwe Zulu. Thank you so much for your time this evening. Let's begin our conversation with, you know, you're one of those of the people who was in exile. Let's share then, in fact, with the viewers tonight, the support the ANC received in Angola.
Thank you very much, Bonnie, and your viewers. Thank you for giving us the opportunity, because while we are mourning the death of the former president, Eduardo dos Santos, we also recall, it's an opportune moment for us to recall the support that we received from Angola and the support that we received in ensuring that we fight, from a military point of view, we fight the apartheid regime, but also it gives us an opportunity to recall the fact that the apartheid regime, as you clearly indicated, was extended in fighting us through UNITA and UNITA rebels. This is a story that, for me, has still yet to be told, because we lost quite a lot of our comrades on the way when we were attacked by UNITA rebels, who had been like an extension of the apartheid regime to deal with us while we were there. Their slogan was, kill them before they get to South Africa to kill us.
And the Angolans suffered immensely, you know, as they sheltered and supported the liberation organization. For example, you look at the Cuito Canavale battle, you know, where the MPLA soldiers led during the battle. Let's talk about that very briefly.
Yes, before we even talk about Cuito Canavale, which was a determining platform in as far as the liberation of Namibia was concerned, We talk also about the fact that there are many villagers who we live next to within the camps who were killed by UNITA rebels, number one. Number two, villagers who suffered because they had to support us and assist us in everything that we were doing. And that's why I'm saying that is yet a story that needs to be told, because there's a lot of Angolans who died for our liberation. And I'm sure that as you read the statement of the African National Congress, it referred to the suffering of the Angolan people. And by the way, It was not only for the ANC, it was also for the ANC, ZAPO, as well as SWAPO, because if we recall in history, the liberation of Namibia had to be discussed, and as the African National Congress and Umkhonto weSizwe in particular, one of the conditions was that we withdraw from Angola. Hence, we left Angola and went to places like Tanzania and Uganda. And throughout that period, it is the support of MPLA and the support of José Eduardo dos Santos in leadership that played a very important role, and his relationship with the leadership of the African National Congress, but as well as the leadership of Umkhonto weSizwe at the time.
And while we talk about President DeSantis' legacy, others are looking at, you know, one part, and, you know, especially coming at the back of what you're talking about, but others are saying, you know, he should be criticized for plundering the resources of his country, even some going as far as saying that he plundered them so much so that he even had to go and be treated in Barcelona and not in his own country, and saying that there's nothing to celebrate there. What is your reaction to that?
Well, when you have a nation that does not see a reason to celebrate liberation, when you have a nation that does not recognize the support that we did, that we got for the liberation, it calls for us to have a deep conversation about our liberation struggle and where we are today. But it further also calls for a deeper discussion with regard to leadership itself, because in hindsight, there's a lot of things that can be said. But right now, as the African National Congress, we are saluting somebody when the chips were down, when everything was difficult for us, was there politically, socially, and militarily, because it is a history that will still be told about how we lived in Angola and how we supported not only by Dos Santos and MPLA, we were also supported by other countries who at the time were supporting us in order for us to get rid of an apartheid colonial system. That task was completed. If we then have to discuss about what happened post that liberation, that's a different discussion altogether that I don't think anyone of us would fear even getting into conversation, because history is not meant for only the past. History is meant in order to assist us towards the future, to say, fine, you liberated the country, what then happened in building institutions of governance? What then happened during that time, and what did leadership do during that time? And if leadership at some point did not do something that is felt like by others that it shouldn't have happened, that is what we need to put on the table and have a different conversation altogether. Right now, the man, the person who supported our liberation struggle, who not only supported the liberation struggle for South Africa, supported the liberation struggle against Ian Smith in Zimbabwe, supported the liberation struggle in Mozambique against the very same Portuguese that had been occupying Angola. Now, right now, this is what we are looking at, and we send our condolences, obviously, to the family and the people of Angola.
And before we end off this conversation, earlier on in the bulletin, we were showing the viewers visuals of Sri Lanka. This has also led to a culmination of a hashtag, for example, that is now trending, which is union buildings. People are restless, they're upset, and they say that maybe it is time to go to the union buildings. They're upset about the rising cost of living, the energy crisis, and all of that, and they say that government is not taking them seriously. You are part of the governing party. How is the ANC responding to this restlessness?
Absolutely. I can say if people are unhappy, the whole world, by the way, is unhappy with the rising food crisis and all. Everyone is happy with the rate of unemployment and all. And I can say, as a member of the African National Congress and as a member of cabinet, we take our people very seriously. That is why, for instance, under the period of COVID-19, we had to sit and look at how else do we change the situation and support our people across the board, whether it was business, whether it was in the social sector, whether it was the petrol itself that actually rose, and we had to sit down and say, how do we address it? Even now, we shall do exactly the same. We are committed to ensuring that we discuss and we engage and we always find solutions to our problem. We are a united nation that needs us all to put our heads together to say, how do we deal with the global challenges that are facing the entire world? How do we, as South Africans, come together and make sure that even the mistakes that are being made, how do we correct them to make sure that our country is not seen in a negative light, not only by ourselves and our people, but the world in general?
You mentioned COVID-19. We saw the president giving regular updates about how the country was responding to this crisis, yet his voice is missing when it comes to addressing the country about this energy crisis. When is he going to address the nation?
definitely the president will be coming out, because in order for the president to address the nation, even with regard to COVID-19, we had special meetings at NCCC and Med Joints and all, where we needed to sit down and plan properly so that we communicate to the people something that people can believe in and something that we are also going to be able to do. Watch the space. The president is going to be making the same family meeting that he had before. He will be doing that because he has already long directed us, all of us, to say, come back to me and tell me what exactly needs to be done to deal with the crisis that the country is facing.
So you're basically saying then, finally, that those who are restless must hold off a little bit. The president will be addressing the nation soon, because we are seeing quite a lot of, you know, restless sentiment on the ground.
We appreciate and understand why there is restlessness, because the economy hasn't been doing very well. People are suffering because petrol prices have gone up, food prices have gone up. We are very conscious of that. And I'm saying to you, the president will be coming out and addressing the nation as we have done so, because we believe we learned a lot through COVID-19. The fact that we had those communications and the fact that we had a family meeting which resonated very well with our people, the same will have to continue, because we need to reassure our people that we do everything we can to ensure that we lighten the difficult life that they are having.
And how important then is it going to be for also those who are deployed into these various portfolios to speak in one voice? Because we've also seen a pulling in different directions between, for example, the Mineral Resources Department as well as the Energy Department. How important is it going to be for the ANC deployees to be able to speak in one voice so we can see this problem resolved?
It has always been very important for us to be seen to be speaking on one voice, because that's exactly the reason why we have a government and we have cabinet, where the president calls us. We have cabinet meetings where we have those discussions about different issues. And one of the issues that has already been dealt with is messages that are conflicting. You are not going to hear nor see any conflicting messages here on, especially after the president, President Cyril Ramaphosa, has directed us not to do that, because it is not in the interest of South Africans. It is not even in the interest of government. It is not in the interest of the African National Congress at all.
All right. So we appreciate your time this evening. Thank you so much for talking to us. That was Lindi Wazulu, Social Development Minister, as well as Chair of the ANC's International Relations Subcommittee.
Welcome back, and that was a report from the South African Broadcasting Corporation interviewing an ANC official about the death of former President, Angola President, Jorge Eduardo dos Santos, and unfortunately the discussion went to domestic issues through the SABC, unfortunately. This is the direction that we see going with the SABC, rather than discuss the contributions of the Angolan people, their government, to the liberation of Southern Africa. Let's listen to another report. This one is on the ANC sending its condolences to the Angolan people.
The ANC has extended its condolences to both the people of Angola and Japan after the death of their former leaders. ANC spokesperson Bule Mavis says the former Angolan president José dos Santos played an important role in the liberations of countries known as the frontline states. On the assassination of the former Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, Mavis says they hope that this tragedy will not play itself out in other countries.
We deep our revolutionary banner. Having learned of the passing on of the former president of Angola, José dos Santos, the MPLA occupied a special place in the liberation of South Africa's people under the reign of dos Santos. They provided training militarily to soldiers of combatants of Mkhonto we Sizwe, who alongside FAPLA, which is the People's Liberation Army of the MPLA of Angola worked to defeat the apartheid machinery in what was to be known as the Battle of Kwetokani Valley. Many of our comrades, cadres, stayed in Angola. They were given homes there under Dos Santos. So we owe a debt of gratitude to the people of Angola, understanding the significant role that they occupied in our national liberation project. And we've also learned of the news, and we're quite shocked, more so because the Prime Minister is said to have been assassinated while he was on a campaign trail. We believe in a free space to campaign. We believe in democracy in this country, and what we will urge the people of Japan and elsewhere in the world is that they must exercise maximum tolerance. Even if you do not agree with your opponents, you do not agree with the ideals that they are pursuing, driving out there. As a peace-loving nation, peace-loving people, we ought to show maximum tolerance. We hope that those things are not going to be replaying themselves in other parts of the world. We convey our condolences to the family of the former Prime Minister and to the entirety of the people of Japan. We call for peace and tolerance.
That was another segment from one of the leading officials of the ruling African National Congress, and of course talking about the international solidarity in relationship to the Republic of Angola, which the late President José Eduardo dos Santos exemplified coming to power in 1979 after the death of Dr. Agostinho Neto, and of course the 1975 crisis in Angola, the Cuban intervention, the support of the progressive and revolutionary states throughout African progressive and revolutionary forces throughout the world between 1975 and the early 1990s, actually, even though the South African Defense Forces were decisively defeated in 1998 in Angola. There was a process of negotiations, political transition in 2000. In 1990, the Republic of Namibia was formed. And of course, in 1994, there was the democratic breakthrough, the independence of the Republic of South Africa, and the ascendancy of the African National Congress to power in 1994. Let's listen to some other analysis. Now, this is from the South African Broadcasting Corporation as well. Sophie Makwena, who is the foreign affairs editor for the SABC. Let's listen.
We begin here. Angola's current president, João Lourenço, has declared 5 days of national mourning following the death of former president José Eduardo dos Santos. President Lourenço described dos Santos as a unique figure of the Angolan homeland to which he dedicated himself from a very early age. The former president died at the Barcelona Tecnon Clinic following a prolonged illness. Dos Santos had been receiving medical treatment since 2019, he ruled Africa's second biggest oil producer for nearly 4 decades and stepped down 5 years ago. His rule was marked by a brutal civil war lasting nearly 3 decades against the U.S.-backed UNITA rebels, which he won in 2002, and a subsequent oil-fueled boom. He was 79 years old. All right, we are now joined in studio by our international news editor, Sophie Mugwena, to speak more on the legacy of José Eduardo dos Santos. Very good afternoon to you, Sophie. Thanks for coming in. Let's talk about, you know, I've been looking at some of the tributes for the late statesman, and I must say it's not all great. One of the labels that are, you know, attributed or put to him is that of being a tyrant. Is it wrong to label him in that way?
Well, I think in terms of his legacy, it is a mixed bag. And I think those people who are critical about his legacy are justified to do so, because much as he was a veteran liberation soldier who fought as part of liberating Angola, but also contributing to the liberation of the frontline states such as South Africa and Namibia then, unfortunately, during his tenure, there were issues that are questionable in terms of how he conducted himself in his style of leadership, but also on issues that are related to corruption. So, yes, indeed, he was this man who went to Moscow, got training there, sent there by MPLA to receive engineering capacity or skills, particularly focusing on oil. That is why he was able to build Angola to be a formidable second largest country in terms of oil production. But we know that there are reports right now, his daughter, who is facing criminal charges for fraud, corruption, and money laundering in the United States of America and also in Portugal. And therefore, I think I understand those who are critical where they come from. But the reality is he also played a very prominent role during the frontline state wars. You know that the South African government then worked with Jonas Savimbi to try and target the ANC members, military members, that is Mkhonto we Sizwe, who were in the camps in Angola. You know, after 1976, most of these students who left South Africa went to Tanzania, and some of them were sent to Angola. If you speak to people like Minister of Social Development, Lindiwe Zulu, she will tell you a different story. Yeah. And I think the same with those who are in exile. And also fighting side by side with people like Che Guevara.
And very interestingly, I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, his contribution to the liberation, not only of his own country, but South Africa. But, and you know, we talk about the fact that his MPLA party members spoke about him well, calling him the architect of peace. But it says something about these liberation movements and these liberation movements that after they've liberated their people, or helped to liberate their people, they're then start to have this legacy, which, you know, is increasingly tarnished by whether it's allegations of rampant corruption and nepotism. And is he one of those that, you know, you could say is, and a lack for a better word, is a victim of this, where you come from this amazing history of being this liberator, but then you become corrupt and you become what we essentially don't want?
Exactly, you veered off the road. I mean, when you look at his history, he did fight for the liberation of the southern region. But unfortunately, him working in this oil industry with expertise, at the end of the day, it was about his family, not the people in Angola. I remember I went to Angola, I think 18 years ago, and that time the Minister of Minerals and Energy then, Dr. Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka, was in Angola to strengthen relations in terms of trade, particularly focusing on energy. And when you leave the hotel, you see the people in the streets. I mean, it was so, for me, it was a cultural shock, because much as we South Africans, blacks in particular, and Africans, have had a terrible history, and where we come from, places are not as good as the ones you'd see in the township, in the towns, but in the townships, our people are very neat and very organized under the same poverty. But when you go to Angola, it was shocking. I mean, I look at downtown Joburg and certain areas in Joburg, I see a picture of Angola that I saw in 1998, not 2018, 1998. I see that picture, and therefore it is quite disturbing. You see that leaders on the continent, many of them, when they have achieved freedom, yes, they forget about their own people and they focus on their own families. We have lots of examples. I mean, you go to the DRC, you go to Zimbabwe, you go to the CAR, you have a similar story. And he stayed in power for too long. People may argue that the Western powers can't dictate to us in terms of the tenure of a sitting head of state. But when a person is in power for too long, we normally say power corrupts. And absolute power.
And I mean, that was 38 years that you speak of,
yes,
that he ruled. Okay, let's park maybe the negative aside. We've spoken about the positive in terms of the fact that his legacy of liberation. But were there any gains, you know, in that 38 years, you know, in terms of for the people? You talk about this poverty that even shocked you as a South African. I mean, can we truthfully say that there were any ways in which he alleviated poverty apart from his own people? Did he, you know, alleviate any any poverty at all? Is there's always a, you know, a good where there is a bad? What can we say in this
particular
case? I think
for me,
case?
Building Angola into a formidable force in terms of oil production, he must get credit. I mean, today, because of the war in Ukraine,
yeah.
you saw all those major superpowers, particularly the G7 member countries, are scrambling for oil, and they are talking to countries such as Angola, Nigeria, to get oil because they can't get oil from Russia based on the sanctions. And therefore, he has built Angola to be a country on the continent we can rely on in terms of energy supply and oil. And therefore, I think he did that. But in terms of ordinary people, he may have done some work to improve their lives. But unfortunately, towards the end, it is just a story of corruption and money laundering. And the daughter right now facing those charges. As we speak, before he died, she was not in good terms with the current president, because the current president is trying to stamp out corruption.
Right.
Other people would argue that he was part of the system because he's part of the MPLA. Mm. It is a similar story to South Africa.
And in fact, he was groomed by Roberto Dos Santos. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in South Africa, we might have a similar situation where the governing party has the good and the bad men and women, and therefore it is a mix. Reaction or a bag that is full of different perspectives.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much. Many thanks to you, our international news editor here at SABC News, Sophie Mugwena, weighing in on the legacy of the late statesman Eduardo Dos Santos.
Welcome back. And of course, again, we have the lacking analysis, and we are here at the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast. And let's listen to another SABC analysis in response to the death of Angolan president, Jose Eduardo Dos Santos, who passed away yesterday at a hospital in Barcelona, Spain, at the age of 79. Jose Eduardo Dos Santos was a wartime president in Angola. He fought the forces of Central Intelligence Agency, the South African Defense Forces, the entire imperialist construct internationally after the death of Dr. Agostinho Neto, who was the head of the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola. Of course, Jose Eduardo Dos Santos took over in the aftermath of his transition and, of course, guided the country over the next decade to end the racist South African Defense Forces presence in Angola, and also to bring about the national independence of the Republic of Namibia and to open up the end of apartheid in the Republic of South Africa, which entailed the release of Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, and Govan Mbeki, and many, many others who were locked up in South African dungeons, who were in exile, returned to the country after 1990. Let's listen to this final SABC discussion about the death of Angolan former President Jose Eduardo Dos Santos.
Let's return now to news of the passing of former President Jose Eduardo Dos Santos, and SABC News international reporter Kailihle Khumalo is with me. Kai, good evening to you and welcome. Of course, at a moment like this, one of the first questions is legacy.
Well, that's right, Iman, especially because, I mean, you go back to the 70s, you know, the role that he played in Angola with his rule really characterized by the civil war that really erupted in Angola. So at some point he was labeled as an architect of peace. But then a lot of things really just went wrong, where we saw rampant corruption. Some of his family members, you look at Isabel Dos Santos, at some point heading Angola's oil company, his son as well, implicated as well in so many cases of corruption. So this is a man really with a mixed bag of reaction, what you've been gauging from Angola. I mean, dying away from home as well, especially from a country that is seen as an oil-producing country, but, you know, with a very uneven distribution of wealth.
You talk about oil producers. It's Africa's number two oil producer. And a lot of questions this evening, as unfortunate as they may be, is why did he have to go outside of the country? I believe he was receiving medical care outside his country since 2019. The picture of Africa, the wealth that is inherent in the country, not necessarily translating into the infrastructure.
Well, that's right, Iman. And also, I mean, for him, it's been very hard, especially since his step down. We saw his successor, President Lorenzo, really having this crackdown around corruption. So some of his very familiar members were implicated. The daughter, in fact, the son is currently in prison serving some charges for corruption and many other things as well. So he has been frequenting Barcelona for some time. So it was quite inevitable that this would be his best choice in terms of receiving medical care. But also just apart from that, Iman, I mean, this is a man, you go back to the history of this country, who was able to open his arms, you know, just in terms of the frontline states, the likes of South Africa, in terms of Southwest Africa, present-day Namibia, in terms of their liberation. This was one of the very central characters in terms of paving the way for our independence.
There's some talk tonight, Kai Lihle via Dos Santos, is one of his daughters, about the possibility of foul play. I believe that they are asking for an autopsy to establish exactly the circumstances around his passing.
Well, absolutely, Iman. So it's one of the daughters who's very concerned around these circumstances because they don't want the body to be taken to Angola immediately. So they want to really satisfy themselves to understand the circumstances. We know for the longest time Mr. Dos Santos has been battling with cancer. But also there are family dynamics at play here with the daughter alleging that the wife, the current wife, they were estranged. So she really wants to know really the real cause behind this particular death.
Talk to us about the reaction of his former colleagues and his peers.
So it's quite interesting, Iman. I mean, you do have South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa saying that this was a gallant freedom fighter, talking about the role that he played in the struggle, talking about the fact that, you know, this was a leader of MPLA, you know, a party that at some point was pitted against the apartheid South Africa, how they waged the war in the 80s, and really seeing quite a number of things. But also you do have a Namibian president, Hage Geingob, as well, saying a giant tree has fallen. So United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres as well, paying tribute and saying, you know, this was a man who was very instrumental in terms of supporting multilateral bodies, really just enabling Angola as a very central player in terms of brokering so many peace deals.
Final question, Kai Lihle, given the concerns around the circumstances of his passing, what do we know about funeral arrangements?
Well, at this particular point in time, Iman, we're not sure, but in terms of the developments back in Luanda, President Lorenzo has announced 5 days of mourning, and it happens at a very critical time in Angola because a lot of political parties are campaigning for the elections coming up in August, so all the political activities have been suspended to allow for the nation to mourn. In fact, to quote President Lorenzo, he said he was one of the very important figures in terms of the country's politics, but also he governed at a very difficult time when Angola was waging this war where so many Angolans died and so many went into exile.
Thank you so much for that and just giving us some more detail, the life, the times, and the legacy of President Eduardo Dos Santos, Jose Eduardo Dos Santos. Thank you very much, Kai Lihle Khumalo.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast. We are listening to various perspectives in regard to the passing of the former Angolan president, Jose Eduardo Dos Santos, and they talk about the war. The war was against the racist South African Defense Forces, the racist apartheid regime, which was overthrown in 1994, which was defeated militarily in 1998 in southern Angola. And, of course, being backed by not only the racist apartheid regime in South Africa, but also the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, and of course, most of the in the United States, being the State Department, the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies, the capitalist corporations, etc. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. We're discussing the recent passing yesterday of former Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos. He was a wartime president. He led the popular movement for the liberation of Angola, the sole legitimate liberation movement and revolutionary government of Angola. In 1975, Cuban internationalists, with the support of progressive and revolutionary forces throughout Africa and the international community, intervened to stabilize, to protect the MPLA government in Luanda, beginning in November of 1975. And, of course, Cuban internationalist forces remained there until early 1989, nearly 14 years. They had deployed Fidel Castro, 350,000 of his own people. Over the course of those 14 years, Cubans who lost their lives on the battlefield in Angola fighting against racism and apartheid. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week. The voice and music of Candy Staten with the song entitled Rock. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. And today is Saturday, July 9th, 2022. And as we talked about last weekend, it represented the 40th anniversary of the unjust incarceration of African-American journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in the United States. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a veteran member of the Black Panther Party. He was a student activist in Philadelphia during the late 1960s. He was a supporter of the MOVE Revolutionary Organization in Philadelphia. And, of course, since being incarcerated in 1981, has continued to write incessantly and exhaustively, as well as providing commentaries to prison radio in regard to the world, overall world situation. And of course, there's a new push for the release of Mumia Abu-Jamal after 40 years in incarceration. A number of those years were spent on death row. An international movement was able to bring him off of death row, yet he was given life in prison with no chance of parole, suffering from various health problems. And, of course, the lack of concrete evidence in regard to the situation on December 9th of 1981 in Philadelphia, where Mumia Abu-Jamal was accused of killing Philadelphia police officer Danny Faulkner. And, of course, that struggle has continued now for well over 40 years. We want to listen to a segment that was done by Mumia Abu-Jamal prior to his incarceration. This was done in 1979. And that was around the time that Bob Marley and the Wailers were doing a tour of the United States. They came here to Detroit in December of 1979. And they were also in Philadelphia on the East Coast. Mumia Abu-Jamal had an opportunity to interview Bob Marley and do this segment back in 1979. Let's listen in to an interview and a new segment on the legendary Bob Marley by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Here is a piece Mumia Abu-Jamal produced with his interview of Bob Marley.
From the sunny isle called Jamaica comes the Rastaman, reggae missionary Bob Marley, one of a growing number of Rastafarians, believers in the divinity of Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, came to Philadelphia recently to talk about his music, his dreams, and Rastafari, a mystic religious community born in Jamaica back in 1930. No reggae artist in the world has attracted the loving accolades of the dreadlocked Marley. Marley is truly a missionary, and his message, one of global black redemption, is contained within the music of Rastafari.
What is the Exodus? Exodus from Babylon. We are the Babylon. And then the physical Exodus to war. So what we really say is that we want the black people to unite with one another and deal with it. No, the only way we can unite is to unite about the truth. The truth is that King Solomon and King David is a root. And if we are dealing with roots, we have to deal with it from King Solomon and King David time, line of tribe of Judah, you know. So, this is what I say, time for unity, you know, because we're the people, we have something, and we have to deal with it. That's why I say, Jeff, on that, you know.
These spiritual descendants of the Jamaican freedom fighters, Maroons, who fled the plantations and set up rebel societies in the highlands, shunned the technological advances of the West. The West, they say, is Babylon, a land of unmitigated evil, greed, and other unsavory characteristics. They're a tribe of vegetarians, eating the fruit and herbs of the earth, not the meat of animal life. They see themselves as natural mystics, with a message for black people the world over. The music is hard, gutsy, bassy, and sprinkled liberally with a message. The unity of the globe's black peoples around the Rastafari. Rastafari was the name of Haile Selassie before he was coronated Emperor of Ethiopia.
When I come here, I really desire to get through to the people. I don't want to come here for joke.
Yeah.
When I come here, when I leave, I want to see people them dreadlock, or see them a Rasta, and get the thing rebellious. That we can't leave, you know, because we can't continue going at the same thing over and over and over and over again. But it's true. Rasta for the people. Rastafari for the people. Seeing capitalism and communism are finished. It's Rasta now. The black man, we have life. That's what we are saying, Ajed. We are saying, give the black man theme we are life now. Make him show your whole government run and how people care for people. We think of the love. We sing the tune them in the church. Black people are singing them in you know. Who is the spiritual people upon earth? The black people. Them are dealing with God. And God not let them down. God dead there. And God said them to unite. Because when you unite, that is the power of God.
That you care. When every time I look around, the people suffer.
Music is militant, its beat moving, its message just is moving.
We're the survivors, yes, the black survivors. I tell you what, some people got everything, some people got nothing.
Survival lurks at the heart of the Rasta message. Survival with little or no money. Survival with the support of community, which only means survival with the spirit of love.
We're the survivors.
Because, you know, the survival of our black people in Rasta, which are going to make the other people survive too. Because if a black man will survive, no one can survive. Learn that. And yet we don't make no weapon. But it's just that if we can survive, nobody else will. To Rasta. So when I come to America, I said, them a dread man. It make my heart feel strong. Yes.
You stand up for your rights. Yeah. Get up, stand up. Jump, jump. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up.
Get up,
stand up. A bit of history now. During the 1920s, Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa philosophy affected much of the thinking of the African diaspora of the Western Hemisphere. Nowhere was he more influential than in Jamaica, his island homeland. In one of his speeches, Garvey, already revered as a prophet in Jamaica, said, "Look to Africa when a black king shall be crowned, for the day of deliverance is near." 1930 witnessed the splendorous coronation of Rastafari, an Ethiopian baron, as the Emperor Haile Selassie, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, conquering lion of the tribe of Judah. Selassie was a direct descendant of David in a line of Ethiopian kings stretching in unbroken succession from the time of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. This event sent many religious Jamaicans to their Bibles, where they found support for this in Revelations, Ezekiel, Isaiah, and many other books. Before long, religious leaders on the island were saying that Garvey's prophecy has been fulfilled and preached to the people to consider Haile Selassie the living God and call themselves Rastafaris in his honor. You've heard the story of one Rastaman, Bob Marley, whose message, in essence, is a message of Rasta. That's survival. Bob Marley in Philadelphia. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting for Uhuru Sound. Hail Jah Rastafari.
Welcome back. And that was a rare archival audio file on interview and segment with the legendary Bob Marley being done by Mumia Abu-Jamal in 1979 prior to his incarceration. We'll listen to some Bob Marley and be back with our concluding segment.
Generation.
And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for today, which is Saturday, July 9th, 2022. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to take you into a series of reports about developments taking place around the world.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
The world today is at a precipitous point. Conflicts raging in several countries are causing global ripples, negatively affecting the lives of people thousands of miles away. In trying to find lasting solutions to some of these global challenges, Chinese President Xi Jinping has proposed the Global Security and Global Development Initiative. These initiatives are aimed at fostering global security as a guiding principle, strengthening international cooperation and development, and accelerating the UN 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. So this week on Talk Africa, we take a closer look at the prevailing global security and economic environment and their effects on Africa. And we ask, how can the two proposed initiatives be implemented to bring about a safer global community with a greater focus on development? I'm Beatrice Marshall. Welcome to Talk Africa. As part of China's drive to find lasting solutions to global development and security challenges, senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi visited Pakistan, the United Arab Emirates, Zimbabwe and Mozambique. Now, while in Mozambique and Zimbabwe, he met with heads of state and discussed increasing mutual political trust, strengthening development initiatives and pushing forward bilateral cooperation. The countries also reaffirmed their commitment to the Belt and Road Initiative. The visit comes in the wake of Chinese President Xi Jinping's remarks at the 14th BRICS Summit in June, where he stressed the need to forge an inclusive, high-quality global development partnership and jointly foster a new era of global development featuring benefits for all. The visit to the two African countries affirmed the importance of safeguarding multilateralism, enhancing the comprehensive strategic partnership between China and Africa, and working together to ensure developing countries do not end up as victims of international crisis. Well, joining me now to take a closer look at some of the security challenges the world is facing and unpack the proposed global initiatives are Professor Rana Mitta, Professor of the History and Politics of Modern China at the University of Oxford. From Beijing, Enoch Wong, Senior Manager Online Education and International Cooperation, Tsinghua University. And from London, Dr. Frankton Chiyamura, Lecturer in International Development, Development Policy and Practice Group, School of Social Sciences and Global Studies at the Open University. Gentlemen, welcome to the program and thank you for joining in this discussion. I want to get a first assessment from all of you very briefly, because it is fair to say that the world is facing a crisis in the international political, economic and security order with unprecedented challenges to peace and development. First, let me get your assessment of the state of the world today. What current global developments have become major points of concern? Professor Mitta.
The first one is climate change. We hear more or less about this depending on what's in the daily headlines. Sometimes when there are wars, which of course are horrific events, which are going to affect many millions of people, we hear less about the long-term effects of climate change. But over time, climate change is clearly the factor which is changing the way in which everything from environment to economics is changing around the world. So that's factor number one. Number two, if we're going to point out things that are happening because of the current global crisis, I would put famine. or at least malnutrition, very much at the heart of what is troubling us. Right now, because in particular of the Russia-Ukraine war, there's a real difficulty with the export of grain to a whole variety of key markets, including in North Africa, for instance. And that is an issue that really must be addressed very, very quickly to prevent mass malnutrition and starvation in many very, very hungry parts of the world. So I give you those two to start with.
Enoch, your thoughts?
I cannot agree more with my colleague there, but I want to take a step back and say COVID-19 really is the big concern. It's spreading human suffering, destabilizing the global economy, and really upending lives of billions of people around the world. The pandemic is an unprecedented, you know, wake-up call in some sense, laying bare really deep inequalities and exposing precisely the threat and failures that are addressed in the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and, as mentioned, the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. So I think it's a great framework, critical framework for COVID-19 recovery that can lead to greener, more inclusive economy and stronger, more resilient society. So in short, I think that the biggest threat or concern is the tremendous progress loss for sustainable development goals due to COVID-19. And we can take action now to turn the recovery into real opportunity to do things right for the future.
All right. Dr. Chiyamura.
Perhaps maybe as a way of responding to this, to sort of take a step back and think about, you know, this interesting book which was written by Pascal Lamy and Nicole Ernesto on the Strange New World, which tried to capture some of these global uncertainties that we find ourselves in. I'm particularly interested in the conclusion chapter of this book where they ask, where is the world headed? And I think it does provide a very relevant and useful analysis to help us understand the future in the present. I mean, for one, we know that there are current geoeconomic and geopolitical forces, and to some extent, the way these forces interact with each other, they may have potential outcomes that arguably may be, you know, dangerous or maybe negative to certain people in certain places or spaces. This range from, I think, you know, the compounding effects, which Professor Nita has already spoke about, the climate change, right, you know, the impact of COVID-19. And then in addition to that, the rising cost of living, debt, inflation, energy and food insecurity. And obviously, you know, it goes without say, you know, the reemergent conflict in Ukraine and, you know, among others, such as those in Africa, the Horn of Africa to be precise, in Yemen, Sahel, the Sahel region. So these are all global crises that our generation are facing and definitely affecting the way we interact as civilization.
Dr. Chiyamura, let me stay with you for the moment because you've mentioned geopolitical forces and, you know, creating global uncertainties, and we are not sure where the world is headed. How much of these events are destabilizing the current work order? Would you say there is an emergent new order as a result of the geopolitical forces?
Well, maybe to begin with, there have been these sort of implications that I talk about, these uncertainties, so to say, they are broad, they are catastrophic, and the implications perhaps will have to do with aspects around the commodity markets, supply chains, financial securities at various scales. This could be at an individual, at a regional, national, international. And the most common challenge amongst these is that they impact everyone, regardless of location. You could be rich, you could be poor, but I suppose maybe they are more felt by those in the global south. So the question of whether there's a new global order emerging is an interesting one. I think we've had this discussion for quite some time. I think I would say for the past decade or so. Of course, there are signs and symptoms that a new world order is emerging, particularly if you want led by a rising power such as China. And I think there are two sides to this question, really. On the one hand, so we have some analysts saying that the rising powers, if you want, not anyhow different from the traditional powers, in the sense that such countries are driven by their own geopolitical and geoeconomic interests.
Right.
But increasingly, I think on the other hand, we have seen that the rising powers have, if you want, developed the means, the capability, as well as the resources to balance out, if not challenge, the dominance of traditional powers, particularly around international norms and practices.
Sorry, let me jump in there, Dr. Chiyamura, and get Enoch's view here. You know, Enoch, in terms of trying to deal with these global uncertainties and all these issues that have been mentioned by the three of you, let's look at what is balancing out here, according to Dr. Chiyamura. You know, is there credence to suggestions that perhaps there's a new way of dealing with these issues? There is a new order now emerging. What is your view?
Absolutely, I would hope so. I think when we look at the global order or the definition of it, we did emerge after the Cold War, and there are a group of countries we call the West that are trying to capitalize on the Cold War dividend, right? They try to maintain their advantages, and by creating this asymmetric and unfair advantage over developing countries, and let me say it's very undemocratic in that sense. But I think there's a new emerging order that are driven by common needs, that are driven by common desire, but not common enemy. Yes, there is diversity. Yes, there's differences, but it's driven by the needs of development. I think there's less about protecting, there's more about progressing. And I think that's what this new emerging order is about.
Right. Dr. Chiyamura, I want to bring this conversation back to where we are today. And, you know, having mentioned all, the areas that the world is struggling to deal with the challenges, where do you see the world headed in terms of coming back to your question of where are we headed?
Well, this is, I think, a very obvious sort of response to this question in the sense that we all know that if we don't do certain things, where will the world be? I mean, it's clear that if we don't design some policies or if we don't come up with some frameworks around global governances, then we are headed for disaster. You know, I think maybe try to think around this is this sort of recent proposal which was made by Xi Jinping last year, if I'm not mistaken, at the General Assembly at the United Nations, where you sort of start thinking about this idea of global development initiative and quite recently as well this idea of global security initiative, which I think for me, obviously maybe the devil's in the details, but I think it's a step in the right direction of trying to come up with some mechanisms that are perhaps inclusive and that have this commonality as sort of the unifying element of it. And obviously I think it does recognize that the current, if you want, global institutions of governance, they seem to be kind of weak in responding to some of these challenges.
Right. Enoch, let me get your thoughts on what Dr. Chiyamura has said here, because when you look at who is dealing with what, and clearly the repercussions for international development as a result of the events you've mentioned have been massive over the last 2 years, what is the role here, though, of the multilateral system in all of this? Are we seeing a far much weaker global institutions unable to deal with these global challenges? For example, the United Nations, does it still hold a position it once did in the multilateral world?
I think that there is a desire for multilateral system to play its role. But unfortunately, for example, you mentioned United Nations. I want to use an example which has been on the news quite a lot lately, the NATO. I think it was once, you know, there was once hope that it could be a Western-led world order after the Cold War ended and could make the world safer. But in the past, it really has exposed itself to be anything but what it claims. I think it really is a monstrous 20th century Cold War relic, and it keeps provoking conflict as long as I think it exists, and it continues to break its promise by expanding it eastward. So I think it is a multilateral system that it's not doing what it's supposed to, besides the fact that it is the world's supreme violator for the UN Charter itself and human rights. But they really doesn't have much respect of the international law, particularly with behavior that created the condition for the Russian-Ukraine conflict. So I think there's a lot that can be done, but then we need to set up a system that we can follow the rules by in order for the system to work.
All right. Professor Mita, going by how NATO is behaving in the recent past, though, is this a continuation of the Cold War mentality? What's your view there?
No, actually, what has been happening with NATO is a very strong adaptation in terms of contemporary circumstances. So it's worth noting that, of course, Ukraine, which has been invaded recently by Russia, was not a NATO member. And, of course, there's a strong argument that if you're Latvian, if you're Lithuanian, if you're living in the Baltics, then right now NATO membership is one of the things that's protecting you from the possibility of a Russian invasion in turn. So I think you have to sometimes remember history. An awful lot of people who live in Eastern Europe from the 1940s onwards have a strong memory of being invaded dominated by what was then the Soviet Union, as well as by Nazi Germany. And that experience of repeated invasion by authoritarian states is one of the things that's turned people in the direction of wanting some kind of mutual protection. And I think if you're looking for successors to NATO or ways to adapt it, that understanding that small countries, and in China there's always been this idea, actually a very long time, of understanding the mentality of how small and weak countries need to be protected.
Right.
That's the motivation, of course, that keeps many people in NATO. So I think one of the things that's really important at the moment is to understand how people see themselves and not simply judge from outside. And that explains a great deal of why so many Europeans value NATO now more than they ever did before.
Enoch, what's your view here? How do you view, you know, the way these multilateral institutions are behaving in this century?
So I think, first of all, I think peace, dialogue, and justice are really the only way out. I don't think any country should be adding fuel and fire and intensifying confrontation. Instead, I think countries should call for ceasefire and end the conflict by supporting Russia and Ukraine in carrying out direct dialogue. I think that's first. Second, Cold War mentality should never, ever be promoted. What I mean by that is that no country should be forced into a friend or foe camp confrontation. We should firmly promote international solidarity and advocate a vision of common, cooperative, comprehensive, and sustainable security and respect and accommodate legitimate rights for sovereignty and territorial integrity according to the UN. And that's very important, according to what is agreed by the common community, especially, as my colleague mentioned, small and developing countries that we have to protect.
Dr. Chiyamura, Africa tends to get caught in the middle of all these events, even though it is a bystander, you know, in terms of participation. What do you feel here, though? Is there a continuation of a Cold War mentality happening here? I mean, how is Africa navigating itself out of all this?
Yeah, well, the situation in Ukraine is very unfortunate, and I think it does sort of attest to this idea of the world regressing rather than progressing. And, I mean, for me, the way I would like to look at it, perhaps, is to sort of look at the conflict from a vantage point of the impact, particularly in Africa. You know, recently, when the chairperson of the African Union, who is Moussa Faki Mahamat, was sort of passing a speech on the Africa Day commemoration, I quote, he said that Africa has become the collateral victim of a distant conflict, that between Russia and Ukraine. So he continues saying, this conflict has upset the fragile global geopolitical and geostrategic balance and is casting a harsh light on the structural fragility of our economies. Indeed, being aware that Russia and Ukraine, they play a very, very big role, particularly around food exports to Africa. And I think the sort of the Ukraine Russia conflict is sort of exacerbating the already existing, you know, sort of fragilities, one of them obviously being the effects of COVID pandemic, and again the climate change, which Professor Mita talked about at the start of this meeting. But worryingly, the rising public debt ratios, and you would know that in Africa at the moment, I think majority of close to, I won't say majority, almost all of African countries are at a stage where they are almost about to reach debt distress. So definitely, you know, these uncertainties are one way or the other affecting African. And indeed, there is need, therefore, for designing some mechanisms and policy intervention that should sort of cushion or, if need be, provide solutions to some of these challenges for African countries.
All right. We are going to look at those solutions in just a moment. Dr. Chiyamura, Enoch Wong, and Professor Mita, do stay with us. We're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we'll take a closer look at the proposed initiatives and how they can be implemented. Stay with us. Welcome back to Talk Africa. Still with me are Professor Rena Mita, Enoch Wong, and Dr. Frankton Chiyamura. Before the break, we looked at the current state of the global economic and security environment. Let's now look at the proposed initiatives and provide some solutions to global uncertainties. Enoch, I want us to expound on some of the responses to these events that we have just mentioned. And just go back last year at the UN General Assembly, where Chinese President Xi Jinping proposed a global development initiative to steer global development. At the Boao Forum in China in April, President Xi also proposed a new global security initiative. Explain your understanding of these initiatives and why they have become central to China.
My understanding of those initiatives is that it really is an expansion of what President Xi Jinping mentioned about changes that are unseen in a century. There's a recognition that the world is changing. There's a recognition that history might change. There's a generational change that is happening. As guests have mentioned, there's changes in climate and biodiversity. There's geopolitical and conflict that's happening. There's pandemic and global health challenges that's affecting everyone, not just some countries. So therefore, really, upon a very, very successful Belt and Road Initiative, there is a proposal of something called the Global Development Initiative, and then later, Global Security Initiative. And those two really go, for me, go hand in hand. It's based on a cooperation and common values of development. And the reason why I think it goes hand in hand is because there's no development unless there's security. And unless there's a security of protection and structure, you cannot really conserve the results of development. So therefore, those two initiatives go hand in hand to really secure a globalized world order that is driven by supply, industry, and value chain across the whole entire world. Those are initiatives that can help us to address some of the systematic risks that we are facing, whether we are developing or developed country. And last but not least, the eight areas from the Global Development Initiative and the six commitment from the Global Security Initiative, those are things that come out of expertise and experience and consolidation of that. And it's a constant changing and iteration dialogue that has been happening throughout.
Professor Mitter, let me wrap you in here because there is clearly a need to look at the security challenges and the development challenges facing the globe today. What's your reaction to what you've heard?
I want to hone in on one and just make clear how central I think it is, and that is security around energy. Because if you don't have energy security, then the economic growth that we've been talking about throughout the entire program simply can't progress. In other words, if we're looking at the emergence particularly of new and emerging markets, it could be in sub-Saharan Africa, it could be Latin America, it could be Southeast Asia and elsewhere, then that growth is going to have to be real to deal with the economic crisis that the world is in. But it also has to be green. Franklin did mention this briefly, but I want to really drill in on this point. It is going to be absolutely essential to find much, much greener forms of energy if we're not going to succumb to the climate change disaster that is clearly heading towards the world. So fossil fuels, I think it's clear across the world now, are going to have to be out as quickly as possible. But in the meantime, we have to think, first of all, what is the future in the short term we have to say for nuclear energy? And secondly, beyond that, what are the real capabilities of technology that enables us to see a proper renewable and green energy sector? Now, China certainly has a role in that particular story, but it's one that it also has to have and will have, I'm sure, in cooperation with other growing tech powers, including India. I want to mention Turkey, which is often not mentioned very much, but actually is a very important economic actor in its own right and has a role in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as in many parts of Asia. And of course, the wider Western world, which has still a tremendous amount to offer in terms of renewables. This is the sort of area where cooperation is not just desirable, it's absolutely essential, and it's at the heart of all the other brilliant goals that my two fellow guests have mentioned.
I want to come back to you, Dr. Chiremura, because you did mention about where Africa is going to be when it comes to security and development. And, you know, these geographical, geopolitical events are showing that today no country or no continent can face the global challenges alone. And Yang Jiechi, who's a member of the Political Bureau of the CPC Central Committee, was in Africa this week. China has also recently convened a Horn of Africa Peace and Development Conference. What do you think the underlying message from China is as the world faces these global headwinds, particularly the underlying message for Africa?
In terms of whether this initiative will really contribute to a difference, I think for me it's a bit too early to tell, particularly around, you know, if indeed they will contribute to a more secure and more balanced global development world. But I think based on sort of the previous based on the assessment, I think, of the ongoing or previous Chinese-driven initiatives, I mean, the one in the case in point here is the Belt and Road Initiative. I think there's scope and hope for changing the world. And I think, however, the question therefore will be around the exact details and particularly the governing structure around these initiatives and how those who perhaps come from a different worldview or from an ideological viewpoint that is different to theirs see this. Is it a threat? Is it an opportunity? And therefore, how would China try to convince those who may have a totally different viewpoint around these initiatives?
All right. Professor Mita, is this a threat? Is this an opportunity? What's your take?
There are very few things in the world that are either simply threats or opportunities. I think what it is more an acknowledgement that the sources of global influence are changing in the world, whether that's economic security, military security, even changes in the way in which global governance are taking part. The whole variety of different actors, including from the global south, are going to have to be included. And I think the most important thing at the moment is to be thinking ahead of time in the way in which the countries which are going to be the major new powers of the next generation. We already have the United States, China, the European Union pretty much sitting at the top table. So the question of who is going to be in the next list of upcoming countries, and South Africa I think is going to be one very good example of how that might emerge, that is the kind of forward thinking that the global order has to do. We sometimes get so caught up with our everyday problems on a day-to-day basis that we don't spend enough time thinking about where the future is going to come. And that will be a really, really important part of any initiative when it comes to international security, to think about what comes next.
And I want to wind up on that note of what comes next. Dr. Chiyomura, I'll start off with you. What kind of security concept do you think the world needs right now? In your view, how can countries achieve that common security and common development?
Well, I think it goes without saying that in each and every conflict situation, if it's a political problem, then you obviously need political solutions to it. If it's another problem driven by maybe economic needs or economic interests, then you should find some solutions that have to do with the cause of that particular conflict. And I think, interestingly and increasingly, there is that need, therefore, to either continue to reform the existing multilateral institutions of governance, but I suspect that there could be an element of resistance, particularly from those traditional development powers who have vested interest in these institutions. But I think equally we also have to think about creating new institutions that, if you want, are responsive and they do understand these different contexts, particularly those coming from the global south. And then the idea, therefore, is sort of tied to what Enoch said earlier on, that what unifies them is common needs, common desires, and common goals, not necessarily common threats or enemies.
All right. Professor Mita, your thoughts?
I think the most useful mind exercise, thought exercise, that we can do in the near future as countries and as citizens is to put ourselves in the minds of those who we think are sitting opposite us on the other side. And this is a very useful exercise in national capitals. I'd like to think that people in New Delhi are thinking about what people in Islamabad think, because Pakistan and India are two major countries in the Asia context who often don't spend enough time thinking about what the other thinks. People in Beijing need to be thinking about how things look from the point of view of Washington. People from the point of view of Washington need to understand how the world looks from Beijing. And all of those actors, I think, need to spend a lot more time thinking about the places which are up and coming in the global south, but have still disappeared from the view in the global north. I'd like to have more people thinking about the view from Brasilia, from Lusaka, from Jakarta, from a whole variety of places that are going to be tremendously important 5, 10, 20 years' time, but which even...
Welcome back, and that was a discussion on the overall global situation, and that's going to be all the time we have for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. Today is Saturday, July 9th. 2022. And of course, we're going to be signing off here with the music of Hank Mobley from the album entitled Another Workout. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. Thank you.
Thank you.